What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, episode 86. We're talking with Dr. Walter Lowe, the evolution of the team physician. The first part of what you're going to hear today is the live recorded session from the Memorial Hermann 13th Annual Sports Medicine Update. So the first part you'll hear will be his presentation, and then we get to take him into a room and interview him shortly after that. So you'll hear from Dr. Josh Yellen interviewing Dr. Walter Lowe about the evolution of the team physician. So thanks for joining us on the Sports Medicine Broadcast.
Is this? Yeah, now you guys can hear me. So there's no handout for this. Thanks for having me again. It's great seeing all you guys. I just rolled in my usual late, so I haven't had a chance to say hi to everybody yet. But, you know, it's a new venue for us here. This is pretty cool. Second Baptist is bigger than U of H, I think, when I got out here because I got lost. So there's no handout for this because I didn't want to be held accountable for any of it. So Bob kind of gave me this weird topic like he always does, and I said, well, I'm just going to get up there and kind of free think and free talk and talk to you guys about it's a little bit about the role of the team physician, but it's mostly about keeping up and new things and how we filter them. So I'll kind of get started. So these are all the things I'd like to cover that I think are a little different than last year, maybe, and that's kind of scary to say some things are different than last year. So I'm going to talk a little, you know, I can't not talk about ACL stuff. So, you know, I had to throw that in somewhere. I'm going to talk about some rehab, some dry needling things that I don't know how much you guys know about that, but I'm going to query you here in a minute. Whoa. A little bit about biologics. We've talked about that before, but it has moved forward some. And then at the end, I'm going to cop a little bit of an attitude with ESPN and some stuff they showed. And I want to give you I guess the feeling of what it's like to be a team physician in the professional sports world right now, where we are guys that run around with a target on our chest, just dodging bullets every day for the most part. And you guys see this? So this is the new ligament. This is the anterior lateral ligament. How many people have heard of that? Anybody? Yeah, so me either. So this was brought up by the Belgium guys a couple years ago. They think it is one of the primary constraints to rotation and help support the ACL, and they've made a big deal about it. Matter of fact, their article, the first article that came out was titled "Freddy Fu is Wrong," and so they really think these capsular ligaments make a big difference. And so really, as we started looking into it in this country, it's really not a new ligament. It has been described many times. It's the part of the lateral capsule that's attached where we see the Sagan fracture, or the lateral capsular sign, when a little flake of bone pulls off the lateral tibial plateau. It's also been called the anterior oblique band. But it really is sort of a capsular thickening in the knee capsule on the lateral side. It's a little bit equivalent, I think, as I start to think about it, to the ligaments in the shoulder. It's just this capsular thickening that certain rotations and motions put it under tension, and it probably does help support the knee like all attachments around the capsule do. But it's not new, and I think the interest, already most of the big industry companies have a way to reconstruct the anterolateral ligament. Everybody is seeing an opportunity for more implants, for more surgery, for all that. But I've gotten old enough that I don't dive into those things right away now, and I tend to want to take a step back and look at it and say, hey, is this real or not? So we have three projects going on at the school right now. I'll just talk about them a little bit. So we did a cutting project where we identified the ligament, which you can sometimes and you can't sometimes, and we looked at the rotations with the normal ACL, without the ACL, and after a reconstructed ACL, and honestly, we couldn't really find a difference with it being cut versus not, other than the knee starts off about 2 millimeters looser no matter how you test it, which is probably important. I really wanted to know if we could see this ligament on an MRI. And so we got about 150 studies that were done at our place. So it was the same radiologist, the same sequences, and all that had only a tear of the ACL. isolated, and then we looked to see. And so we actually could identify this thickening in 32% or 49 of them, and 31 or 63% of those actually had a tear or an injury in that part of the capsule. So it is an area when a pivot shift happens that there is some capsular failure. So that's all we know about it right now. And so I think you'll start to hear more and more because we have this issue. You know, you guys have heard a lot in the last 2 or 3 years about moving from non-anatomic to anatomic reconstructions. And that's all great, and it makes perfect sense. And I think Freddie Fu was right about that. But the problem is that these grafts that are placed anatomically now have to be a real ACL. The old grafts didn't have to be an ACL, and so they didn't see high stresses. They all healed. Very few of them retore, but they really didn't control rotation. They didn't protect the meniscus. They didn't protect against arthritis, all those things. Now we got a problem with the new anatomic grafts in that they have to be a real ACL, and they're seeing real ACL forces, and they are tearing and re-tearing more often than the old ones did. So now we have this problem, you know. We can do an anatomic reconstruction and send these kids out with a bigger risk for tear, or we can do a non-anatomic reconstruction and they'll be protected from that, but 10 years from now their knee is going to be worn out and missing their medial meniscus and all that. So as much as we think we know about the ACL and how to fix it, we really don't know jack yet, and we need to keep looking. And this ALL is just one of the many things that will add to our ability to protect the knee, I think, once we get it figured out. The other thing from my standpoint I really wanted to talk to you guys about is, we don't assess graft healing very well. And so we've always just presumed that by this date on the calendar and they've done these things in rehab that it's fine. And with these new grafts, it's not. And so now these grafts see high stresses early on. And I think I don't think there's going to be anything called accelerated ACL rehab anymore. And you guys may throw books at me or coffee at me or something else, but now we have to find a way to get these grafts to heal. And probably one of the most important things to do is slow down and take the stress away from them until they've had a chance to revascularize, to heal, to become a graft that can respond and not start banging away on them right away. So I think you're going to see some changes in rehab and a lot of debate about that as we try to get these anatomic grafts to heal and hold up. We probably need to have an evaluation of healing before we send people back, because they all heal at different rates. Different grafts heal at different rates. Allografts and autografts heal at different rates. All those things. So, is that a high field, study like an MRI? Is it a dye study? Who knows what it is? But I think you're going to see in the next few years much more attention to, one, are you physically ready? Two, are you mentally ready? And three, is your graft healed enough to take these stresses? So in a world we've all been very comfortable in for the last 20 years, and I've been here a little longer than that now, which is kind of scary, but all of these things, I think, are fixing to change. We have projects going on all of these right now. The one I'm most interested in is the bottom line there, this mental readiness, and we've been handing out validated questionnaires for about the last 6 months to all the kids that come in with the torn ACL, and we don't have our numbers up yet enough to say what it's going to be and what it's not, but it's really interesting to me that about half of them come programmed in that come hell or high water, they're going to come back and they're going to play, and the other half come in checking all the wrong boxes that they're never going to do it again. And I think it's a real testament to what happens in youth sports right now, as I'm viewing that group as the group that didn't want to be playing it in the first place. And now their ACL tear, their recovery from it, is something that's going to be their validation to not have to play it anymore, which was kind of interesting to me. And we started this because of the Vanderbilt study that came out 2 years ago that said return to play after ACL is just 67%. And I kind of wanted to know why. Because physically, I see that number is much, much, much higher than that. And so, again, some interesting things on the psychological or mental side of it coming up too. So from a rehab standpoint, I just wanted to show some of the things we do to evaluate and look at it over at the Texans. I think it's fun for you guys as trainers and physical therapists to see some of this stuff. But I do think the more you watch guys do things, the better feeling you have of, are they really capable and ready yet? So will you run the first video for me? Are they back there? No, you got to go back. You have to move the cursor up onto the video. There you go. Now you press the little arrow. All right, thanks. So, this just a balance exercise early on in rehab. Depot here is getting over an Achilles tendon on his left leg. Go to the next one. Same thing as before. So this is Cushing coming back from this year's surgery. Again, I think this is pretty early on in his rehab. This was about 4 months into it. But this was just a lateral side repair. He always has his attitude at the end. Go to the next. I can go to the next slide. Same thing, another very early on exercise. Again, this is probably around that four-month period. And these things that are predictable, is where you need to get comfortable. And I'm showing all these because we now have a And then the next one. We now have 15 tests that are objectively measured and validated that you have to score above a 95% on for us to let you go back and play. And that doesn't really happen till way out, 7, 8, 9 months in that time frame. And then the last two. Go ahead and run the first one, just showing that he can get really ballistic off of his leg. It's his left leg again. That's a 4-foot box. I can't do that, by the way, and my ACL's fine. But just to show he is human here, this is great. Oops. Anyway, and can you go to the last one now and turn the sound on? But this was proof to me that he was really ready psychologically to come back and play.
Go!
You can see Roland coaching him along there. So good. Anyway, now I know he's ready because he's crazy and that's proof he's still crazy. And so I asked Bob last night, did I show the Cushing video and of him dancing? He goes, nada, I don't think so. I think I would have remembered. And I said, yeah, you would have remembered it. So I'm going to show it tomorrow. So the next thing I want to talk about is some new stuff in rehab. And there's a lot of new things going on that we actually have the opportunity in the pro training rooms to use before you really get to use it in the clinics and those places. And so dry needling is something. How many of you guys have heard of it? Most everybody. Great. How many of you guys do it? Nobody. All right. So it's formerly known as trigger point dry needling or TDN. It's a technique that uses thin monofilament needles to deactivate, desensitize trigger points within the muscle. And I've had it done to me actually several times because I was a real skeptic. And when I got cured of a chronic hamstring I'd had for a year in one treatment, I went, maybe I'm not such a skeptic anymore. And so if you look at the Texan training room, we probably dry needle in season maybe 10 to 15 guys a day. Okay. And the way this works, and these are the little needles you see down there in the bottom right. The cartoon at the top is pretty much true. They do this stuff. Any muscle that has an issue, I think, is applicable to treating. I literally did not feel the needles going in at all. Now, when they hit the trigger point, you know they're in the right place. That's for sure. And these trigger points are kind of interesting when you look into the science of it. You know, they're known to have abnormal electrical activity. So the neural pathway is jacked up at these trigger points. And at that point, they're surrounded by chemicals that sensitize the nervous system, and so that essentially cause pain. And so the research has shown when a needle is put into that trigger point, it causes a local twitch, and you see that, and the guy is doing it, go, that's the spot, and you feel that too. And so when you get that twitch and you sort of change that firing pattern, then it sort of returns the electrical and chemical environment back to normal, and the muscle kind of lets go. And it's as simple as that, but I think it's going to be one of the biggest things we do to keep guys on the field, okay? And, you know, right now the chiropractors are doing it. There's a few. There's some physical therapists that are doing it and taking the courses. I'm trying to get Wayne to get our group there, and our group's going to be doing this very shortly. I think I'm piloting with one of our interns at the Texans, Travis, to use delegated authority. So hopefully athletic trainers can be trained to do this, because I really think it's where it belongs. And so Travis is doing the courses, and the state has allowed us to do it. I think he's the first athletic trainer to apply to do it. But it's something I think you guys should be very interested in. It helps. It's easy to do. It's not dangerous, but you have to have a pretty good understanding of the anatomy you're treating, which should be good for all of us anyway. So that's my spiel on dry needling, but it is new and it is effective. And I think if you pull the pro training rooms right now, it's in every single one of them and being used on an extensive basis. Just a little update on biologics, because I've talked about PRP here, and now, like everything, we have super PRP. So, you know, there's all this talk about stem cells, and I think we need to be very careful how we use the term stem cells, because we're not really necessarily applying stem cells, even when these products say we are a little bit. So these mesenchymal stem cells, we definitely know they have the ability to differentiate into different types of tissue, cartilage, ligament, tendon, bone, all those things. They can accelerate healing, even intervertebral disc, and that's what we're looking for. This is a picture down here of a patellar tendon graft. I don't know if you can see it for the light, and the cup of red stuff is bone marrow aspirate that's been spun down and isolated the platelets and the mesenchymal stem cells that we put on the patellar tendon as we're repairing it, on the graft as it goes in, on the allografts as they go in, to hopefully accelerate the healing response. And so we've sort of morphed from PRP, which is basically platelets in a semi-concentrated form, to the bone marrow aspirate that super concentrates platelets to 10 times as many as is in PRP. And you do get some bone marrow stem cells. Again, there's none in PRP, and that's what this Angel device is that has just been released right now, where we can actually take bone marrow. It's just done with a little needle into the iliac crest or into the knee. You could probably do it away. Guys don't even know they've had it done, when all of our football players who put to sleep because they all hate needles. But anyway, and we can separate out and dial in what we want, what concentration of platelets, red cells, white cells, stem cells, those things. And so this is the new evolution of us being able to hopefully biologically accelerate healing. Again, it's out there before there's proof that it works. But this is something that makes sense. We know isn't dangerous. It comes from your own body. And when you see the people that you use this bone marrow aspirate on post-op, my PA say, could you please do it on everybody, because they don't hurt as much, they don't swell as much, they tend to get over it. And that's all very anecdotal, but both of them have said it's just a big difference when you use it and when you don't. So I think there's something to it. So this, can you run this video now? So I'm going to run grab a drink of water. This is about a 4 or 5 minute video. You guys may have seen this. This was while I was on vacation and basically ruined my vacation. Can you turn the sound on again?
ACL injuries. 8 ex-players are named in the suit, including 3 members of the Super Bowl champion 1985 Bears. Those 3, Jim McMahon, Richard Dent, and Keith Van Horn. Lawyers seek class action status and said in the filing that more than 500 other ex-players have signed on. Hall of Famer Chris Carter spoke about it with Mike and Mike on ESPN Radio this morning, along with former NFL standout R. Marcellus Wiley, who said he is considering joining the lawsuit.
There's a culture of coercion in the NFL. The pressure to take from a team doctor whatever he prescribes, who's the same guy that's paid by the team and whose allegiance is to his employer, the team, and not his patient. And that's wrong. NFL doctors exist. Their existence is a conflict of interest to NFL players. So my stance is not a money grab. I've been working for the NFL and ESPN since 1997, so I have plenty of money. My responsibility of having two shows on ESPN and being a former player of this fraternity is to evoke change.
But what about the information to the player? All right, we understand the league, and it's just like the concussions. We're a lot smarter today than we were 10 years ago. But what about the player and his own personal responsibility as far as getting in that line to get that Toradol shot? Like, I had a choice to get in that line. I had a choice to get the pills, but I didn't take it. I didn't get in that line.
When you go to a doctor, which is your team doctor, and remember, when you go to your team doctor, that's already your second opinion. Your first opinion is your team trainer, who now consults the team doctor. When two medical professionals sign off on what you're about to take, and in that conversation, they never tell you that your body will lock up and your kidneys will shut down at the age 39 like me. When they never give you the horror stories, when you never hear of the ill side effects, that's negligence. Now, understood, you don't have to take these things. But then if you want to take that analogy all the way through, you don't have to play in the NFL. If you're not on the field, then you're a liability. What's the best ability in the NFL? Trent Dilfer says it all the time. It's availability.
It's a great time to bring in NFL analyst Mark Schlereth. You had 29 surgeries in your NFL career. It is really just mind-boggling. Mark, what was your experience when it came to teams and how they handled painkillers and their players?
Well, my experience in the two organizations that I played for was that it was handled, I thought, where the doctors and the trainers did a great job of informing us, also did a great job of being gatekeepers. Could you get it? Absolutely. But was it monitored and was it very carefully doled out? Yes, it was. And so that was my experience in the National Football League. I had great doctors, I had great team physicians, I had great trainers, guys that I trust, guys that I understand. I think what we're talking about here and the problem, there's a delineating line that really separates this in two different categories. We're talking about guys who are addicted to pain pills. I'm a personal responsibility taker. I took Toradol shots. I took painkillers. I did all those things. But I didn't get addicted to them because I knew the pitfalls of taking those drugs and using those drugs. I abused anti-inflammatories during the course of the season. As soon as the season was over, I went cold turkey on all that stuff because I understood and I was informed about what I was doing to my body. I understood that playing in this league was gonna have a lifelong consequences, lifelong repercussions based upon what I was doing to my body. I accepted that willingly and I would do it all over again. But the difference is here now, the delineating line is, are guys being mistreated, misdiagnosed? Is there some malfeasance along with that diagnosis to get you to play knowing full well that you probably shouldn't play? And that's the real question here about the lawsuit. And I believe that in certain situations, yes, that does occur. There's no question about it. And Marcellus is right in this. Those surgeons and those team doctors work for that organization. Mm. So, you know, when a guy gets knocked out of a game, remember a couple of years ago when Matt Schaub took a vicious hit and gets knocked down. I mean, it was ugly. And he's laying face down on the ground. And the doctor comes out and checks on him and essentially says, well, I performed a concussion test. Impossible. And he's back in the next series. Impossible to do that when a guy's face down on all fours. So does that doctor work for the Houston Texans or does that doctor work for Matt Schaub? And my feeling would be that doctor worked for the Houston Texans at that point. And so you have to understand, and you have to get, you know, who's paying that salary and who they're beholden to as team physicians. So I do believe there's a fine line that they walk. I think most of them try to err on the side of good judgment toward the player. But the bottom line, there's a lot of pressure on those doctors as well. And here's one solution that would help that. If the contracts in the National Football League weren't written on toilet paper, because that's what they're worth, if they were actually guaranteed contracts, I believe the organizations would have a vested interest, a real vested interest, and not just lip service like Roger Goodell comes out and says safety is our number one concern. A real concern for the player's health and well-being. If you were invested in that guy for the next 7 years, when he has one of those injuries, you're going to treat it appropriately as opposed to just getting him back on the field. So in my mind, there's two separate things. I take personal responsibility for everything I ever put in my body. 100%, that's on me. I did it willingly, and I knew what I was getting myself into. But the misdiagnosis, trying to get a guy to play that shouldn't be playing, does that happen? 100%, there's no question in my mind that happens.
I told you he was a good person to ask.
So he actually brought up the real point at the very end, and that's the players' contracts and the new collective bargaining agreement. And we as physicians happen to be the easy target to make that happen. So I took exception to his comments, as you can imagine, because he wasn't there. First of all, Matt was never on his back, so he started off, or on his face, he started off wrong. Matt cut about half his ear off and hurt like hell. The blow was brutal. He did get taken to the sidelines, which they didn't show, obviously. He did get questioned on the sideline. He had zero suspicion of a concussion, even though he got the, you know what, knocked out of him. And he never had a concussion symptom afterwards and never had a concussion symptom the next week, never went on the injury report, and never one time had any issues with that hit. There's a lot of brutal hits that don't hurt anybody in the NFL. It's amazing sometimes. Walking off the field that day, I got called by the commissioner's office and said, why didn't you take him out of the game? I said, Elliot, he was fine. He didn't have a concussion. He goes, well, it looked bad. So that play actually changed the rules now. And I'll go over a little bit of Allen's role and the ref's role and all of that. But now we have to take players out of games for suspicious hits. Okay, not based on their evaluation, not based on our medical expertise, not based on questions, not based on anything other than this looks bad and appears bad, so you got to take them to the locker room. You know, and you guys have been around a bunch. Sure, coaches can put some pressure, but I got to tell you, it's less at the pro level than it is at any level I'm involved in. And it's most at the high school level of any of those three, where those kids are probably most susceptible to those injuries, more so than the guys who have survived that experience for several years. So, you know, I just wanted to show the role here. If you look at what we do, and I don't know how many of you guys understand what it takes medically to put on an NFL game. You know, so we have not part of our staff, but there's Alan and Bill Wisson usually up in the booth that are the athletic trainer spotters, and they do a great job. If anything looks weird, there's a call, come to me. I think they would attest. I probably call them more than they call me to see plays after it, because you do learn a lot. It's just like taking a good history from seeing exactly what happened. We sort of have a deal now when I go out, Littner or Flores goes and looks at the video to see what happened so we can talk about it when we come off. We have the two neurosurgeons, one on each side, that we have incorporated into our group of evaluating concussions. So we bring them on the sideline, take them to the locker room anytime, not just if we have a question. They've actually made a big difference, believe it or not, of putting guys back on the field, not keeping them off. So we actually had two guys we took to the locker room that our evaluation thought they were okay, but we would not have played them just because of the NFL. Neurosurgeons cleared them. We had a talk and decided to let them go back and ended up being fine and good decisions on both. Our game day coverage is three sports-trained orthopedic surgeons. It's a foot and ankle surgeon. It's a hand surgeon. It's an internal medicine, sports medicine physician. It's two emergency two emergency medicine physicians, one to manage airways, the two neurosurgeons, three PTATCs, three other ATCs, a dentist, and two chiropractors, okay? We don't have all those people out there to not do something, okay? We have all those people out there so that anything that happens in an NFL game, our players can get the best evaluation of. And so, you know, we're at the point, I am now on the executive committee of the NFL team physicians, and we're at a point now where we're the third cog at the NFL that has to have a marketing group and a lobbying group and a group to fight back, because as the new collective bargaining agreement approaches, the medical things are going to be used against the NFL, and we're going to be the pawns the Players Association uses to play them. So it's a very interesting world to be a team physician, and I wanted to bring it up here because I think you're going to see our roles change, you know, and we're going to have to adapt to that and understand where we draw the line. We don't travel with pain meds, you know. We have 10 Vicodin locked in a safe. If a visiting player needs it, we'll give them two to get on a plane and call in a prescription for them to go pick up. I mean, it's a very tightly run group. Players get blood tested in May, in July, in October, and at the end of the season for everything known to man to manage anti-inflammatories, all of that. But we wanted to have a informed consent document for players to sign to take Toradol, to take pain meds and all that, and the Players Association Union came back and restricted us from having players sign for their consent. So you can hear all this stuff, but when you live it, you realize it's all BS, and it's all about something much bigger than player safety on both sides. It's all about money, and that's really what the pro sports world is right now. So with that, I'll leave you guys for the rest of the morning, and thanks everybody for coming. Any questions?
Hey, this is Dr. Josh Yellen, Program Director for the Master of Athletic Training Program at the University of Houston. I'm sitting here with Dr. Walt Lowe. Dr. Lowe, thank you very much for joining us.
You bet. Thanks for having me here.
Thank you very much. Dr. Lowe, for a little of his bio, he is a team physician for the Houston Texans, team physician for the Houston Rockets, team physician for the University of Houston Cougars, go Cougs, and he has signed on to be a preceptor with our program, and we've signed a nice affiliation agreement with him and his department. I want to ask you a few questions today about your lecture and some of the advances of being a team physician in the NFL.
You bet.
So can you tell me a little bit, how long have you been a team physician now in the NFL?
Well, ever since the Texans were formed. So I started working for them in 2001. Our first football season was 2002. And then previously I had been the head team physician for the Houston Oilers the last 2 years there in town. So I think that puts me at about 14, 15 years now.
And before coming to Houston, or before getting into the NFL, tell us a little bit about your background and what you did.
Well, like I tell my kids, I graduated from the 27th grade, you know, so, you know, the usual route to med school and orthopedic residency. And then I did a sports fellowship at the Curl and Job Clinic in L.A., where part of our job was taking care of the Rams back then. Uh-huh. They were still in L.A., the Dodgers, the Kings, the Lakers, you know, the L.A.
What years were you there?
I was there in 1990 and 1991.
You know, I'm wondering if I was one of your patients.
Might have been.
Because I was a high school athlete in Los Angeles.
Really?
Then. Yeah.
Really?
That's where I'm born and raised.
Did you see one of the guys there?
I believe so. Yeah, I was, cool. For a number of different things. I wonder if I came across you. You know, I was.
I looked totally different. I had hair.
I was 17 and had no brain, so I couldn't remember anything.
Yeah, I gotcha.
So you've been in the NFL now for 14, 15 years, and you've been in the NBA now for how long?
My first year with the Rockets was 1993 when they were in the World Championship, and 1994 when they won it again. So that was a pretty good start. And then there was about a five-year hiatus I took until 4 years ago, and then I've been back. So again, I did it a long time. So probably 17 years in the NBA.
And then tell us a little bit about the University of Houston. How long have you been the team physician there?
Well, since 1993. Okay. So I think if you actually do the numbers, this will be my 23rd year there with Mike O'Shea, the head trainer, and I came in at the same time. And it's still my first love.
Yeah.
You know, it's still the most rewarding part of the sports experience.
Well, we really appreciate you being a part of our program and allowing our students to rotate with you. And I think the relationship is going to grow famously.
For sure.
A couple questions about your lecture today. Tell us a little bit about the anterior lateral ligament and what your thought on it is, and what do you think clinically it does?
Well, let's start with what it is. What it is a capsular thickening of the knee capsule on the lateral side of the knee. And it functions much like what I believe, the more I'm looking into it, like the shoulder ligaments do, like the glenohumeral ligaments, where it's not a free ligament through the middle of the joint like the ACL or the PCL or something. And so that thickening gets brought into play by certain ranges of motion, certain rotations, those kind of things. And so that's what it is. Now, how big a role it plays in stability, I think, is really debatable right now, because there's some release reconstruction dissection studies that says it plays a big role. There's other ones that say it doesn't play much of a role at all. So I don't think we understand the capsular thickenings of the knee yet. There are some on the medial side, all that. I think they're critical for us reestablishing normal stability when we're treating patients with torn ACLs. And I believe the capsule will begin to play a role in that. I don't think we know what role it'll play yet.
And so looking at that ligament clinically, obviously if you're going to test an ACL, the Lachman test has the most reliability and validity as a test, followed by the anterior drawer. And then we can do a pivot shift or a slocum. Looking at that particular ligament, if you want to include some sort of rotational aspect of it, what kind of test would you do, or would you just rely on an MRI?
Well, it's I'm not sure we can diagnose that tear clinically. I think it's too subtle. The thought is that those athletes that have a torn ACL and have injury to this lateral capsule will have a greater pivot shift. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so that is something that should sensitize us to looking closer at that lateral side. In the acute injury, almost everybody's sore laterally. Mm-hmm. Okay. So tenderness over there, pain over there, because in the giving way episode, the big bony bruise we see happens mm-hmm. laterally. But that makes you understand a little more why this capsular issue happens out there too, because all these big compressive and rotation forces are centered out there in the lateral tibial plateau. Mm-hmm. So there, I don't think there's going to be much of a office physical exam for the anterolateral ligament. And so I think its injury is going to have to be delineated by the MRI. And that's never been done before. And that's a study we just finished where it's in line to get published, going to be presented at our academy next year. So you can see that ligament in a fair number, about 70% of normal knees.
Okay.
And in ACL injured knees, it isolated injuries to the ACL, it appears to be injured in about 40% of them. And so it is definitely part of the injury pattern that comes with a, a non-contact type ACL tear.
And so really what you're talking about is that athlete that takes a step, rotates, with the tibia planted and, obviously all that.
Pop, there it goes,
yeah,
right.
And there it goes. And so clinically in your office, if a patient were to come see you, you do a Lachman first, and then you do a pivot shift, or you go right to the pivot shift, because we all know if we do the pivot shift, we got one time to do it.
Yeah. I will attempt a pivot on the field mm-hmm. while everybody's still totally freaked out. I don't even do a pivot on acute ACLs in the office. I do a Lachman, and that's pretty much it. I think that test in my hands is virtually 100% diagnostic. Mm-hmm. I will pivot them when they're asleep to determine that, but it's just not really nice to pivot people when they're awake.
It hurts too much.
Yeah.
And so in that
little three-minute period,
in that little three-minute period when all the chemical mediators are influxing the capsule and they're still kind of in that tissue shock, that's when you go in for the pivot.
Right. And on the field, it's pretty easy to just, slides in and out. We know what this is and move on.
Yep.
Right.
Okay. Now, if you were to, obviously the patient's diagnosed and they go in for surgery and then you refer somebody back to rehab with an athletic trainer. And what's some of your concerns about if you see some involvement in the anterior lateral ligament, what are some of your concerns that, we talked about briefly in your lecture the accelerated rehab of the ACL. And some of the things that I've always been taught, which might have been counterproductive or counterintuitive, was that really focus on the hamstrings, because the hamstrings are doing dynamically what that ACL is doing statically. And then we talked a little bit about backing off that accelerated rehab. From a physician standpoint,
Tell us a little bit more about what you see.
Well, I think that accelerated rehab has become an oxymoron. is exactly what I think. And, you know, and I mentioned it briefly in there, you know, we've now become very anatomic with our placement of these ACL grafts. And in doing so, we've created a problem by asking tissue that we reconstruct the ACL with, a patellar tendon graft or those things, to actually resist the forces of an ACL. And in the previous days in this country, when these reconstructions weren't very anatomic, these grafts didn't see true forces of the ACL, and so they didn't tear very often. Well, these new grafts are tearing more frequently, and that's a big concern, of course. And that's really, I think, what's prompted this investigation into the ALL and other contributing stabilizing factors that may help us protect these grafts if they are reconstructed or repaired or, mm-hmm. or whatever ends up happening from this. I think it's too early to tell. And then the other thing is graft healing. You know, we've never really studied that or made it a part of us returning kids to play. And now that we have these high forces early on and these grafts, I think we're getting at the point, or I am, where I have to see a living dark black ligament on an MR for me to feel comfortable that ligament's ready mm-hmm. to see those forces again, regardless of how good the kid looks. You know, and that's why I said the accelerated rehab is kind of an oxymoron. I think we do need to go slower. We do need to protect these grafts. I think that's going to end up probably being our key to having them heal and get our injury rates back
down. So you're really looking back at, you know, something that we all learned in the beginning of school, which is we need to be able to look at the patient physiologically
right.
and not necessarily look at them functionally
right.
and make our diagnosis and decisions based on our physiological information, not necessarily on what we see the patient being able to do.
Right. I mean, totally. And we all know after doing this for a while, there's people that do things very early and get away with it.
Right.
But it's our responsibility to get as many of them back to doing it again and get away with it at the same time.
So going back to that ACL repair, and then I've got a couple more questions for you, and then, you know, you've probably got to get going here. But when you go do an ACL repair, are you doing cadaver, allograft? Are you doing semitendinosus autograph? Are you doing bone patellar bone autograph?
I don't think you can do the same graft on everybody and have everybody end up good. I think there are places where all three of those grafts play significant roles. In the athletic, young athletic population, and I'm 57 now, so that goes all the way to 57, you know, I use a bone tendon bone patellar tendon graft. You know, it is our graft that has the most predictable healing into the bony tunnels we put it in, because it has the patient's own bone and their bone
right.
tunnels. And that healing not only happens rapidly, but it happens predictably. And that's not the case with tendon and bone tunnels. Allografts play a role. They play a role in the blown up knee that there's not enough tissue from the patient to fix mm-hmm. it, the big knee dislocations where everything are torn, and in guys like me that don't do things that put the ACL at risk very often, a ski trip a year or a mm-hmm. couple of ski trips a year, and other than that, you're in the gym working out, you know, doing a few little things. So exposure is a big deal about re-injuring, mm-hmm. you know, your ACL, and I think the young kids that go hard and go hard every day, I believe we need to make the decision on which graft has the least chance of re-tearing, and that's our patellar tendon graft.
Bone patellar bone. Yeah. Right.
So probably 75% of what I do, because that's my patient population, are BTB patellar tendon grafts.
Good. Going back, something that you brought up, I think were two very interesting concepts. One is that mental readiness of ACL return to play, and the other one is that you brought it up you have a specific, I think you said it was 95 things they have to pass?
No, 15 things.
15 things. Yeah, that's what I thought.
15 things.
I heard it wrong. Yeah. But you have a mental readiness checklist, and then you also have 15 physical things that they need to be able to pass. Can you talk a little bit about the 15 different things and what kind of activities are
you
looking for?
Well, they're basically a lot of what everybody knows. That, you know, the basics are the single leg hop, you know, comparison. That's a very simple one anyone can do. A timed shuttle run, where we have norms for age groups. Mm-hmm. We even have norms for positions mm-hmm. in football. So a timed shuttle run, a timed cone drill, same thing. We have norms for ages, norms for positions, you know, vertical jump off of one leg. There's a couple of landing tests that fit more for the young women than the young guys, that they have to have control of their knee. They have to fire their hamstrings on impact. They have to have a flexed knee and hip, you know, as they do it. Even a single leg squat is one of them, where they have to be able to not only keep their knee from falling into valgus, but they have to keep their pelvis from lowering at the same time. And so there's a bunch. There's some that go out on the field that are more advanced than that, that we're trying to validate right now. So we're using them in the pro football training rooms. We're not using them in the physical therapy clinics yet. But even the simple ones are very telling, I think. And so I do believe we need to have a test that kids need to pass before they get so-called cleared.
Right.
You know, and if we do that, we're going to decrease the number of retears that happen for sure.
And if somebody wanted to access these 15 diagnostic
they
tests,
can email me.
They can email you directly. What's that email?
It's a long one. It's walter.r.lowe@uth, like University of Texas Health, .tmc, like Texas Medical Center, .edu.
And Lowe is spelled L-O-W-E.
Correct.
Right. If you want to learn more about Dr. Lowe and some of his background, you can go to our website, www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT. That's for the Master of Athletic Training Program. And Dr. Lowe is one of our affiliates, and you can click on the link that says Partnerships and pull up the University of Texas Health Center Department of Orthopedics. One more thing that I want to ask you about is the mental readiness.
Mm-hmm.
I've always believed in the mental readiness, that I can really put somebody on a Biodex and show them physically, hey, listen, you're 110% of your unaffected leg, you know, go down that line. But you know what? When I bring them back to what I like to call the scene of the crime, they can't do it. They can't reproduce it because there's that mental block. So tell us a little bit more about that. We all saw a video that you put up of we knew that a patient was mentally ready.
Right. Well, that was a little tongue in cheek, obviously, that video, but that's always been an interest of mine. And a couple of years ago, Kurt Spindler and the guys at Vanderbilt and the Moon Group published a return rate to same level of sport after ACL reconstruction of 67%. And that to me was a shocking number because, seems to me like they all went back when you take care of them as patients on a one-by-one basis, or most do. So that's what forced me to begin thinking about what else is playing a role in them coming back. So this study we're in the middle of right now, we're still enrolling patients, and I think we have about 100 in it right now. And for power, we need about 200, which will happen pretty quick. And so we've been giving these questionnaires on a first patient visit and every subsequent patient visit, both pre-op, post-op, as we go through. And it's a questionnaire that has several visual analog scale questions for them just to pick where they are from 0 to 10 on a bunch of different mental issues. Some that are kind of weird, joy, happiness, you know, stuff like that. But other things, you know, do you believe you'll come back and play your sport? You know, are you worried about it? Simple things that you'd go, whatever. And like I said in there, it's been interesting. I've sort of read through every chart when I go through, because they're all in them when I'm seeing them post-op and everything. And these kids actually divide themselves into two groups, and they're the true believers and the true non-believers, you know. And as I start to think about it and look at the individual kid and stuff, I think it's a comment. My take on it, it'll be interesting if I'm willing to write this down the line, but I think I will if it continues as it appears to go, is that there are a lot of kids that never wanted to play this sport in the first place.
And this gives them a way out.
And this gives them a way out. And they come in ready to take that way out from the very beginning.
Right.
And they don't change no matter how good they look.
Right.
On a physical exam. And so I think it's a question of parenting. I think it's a question of why do you play sports that put your health at risk, and probably one that kids don't get to make consciously on their own sometime, is sort of the take I'm getting from this. And I believe that's the group that is the predominant group that does not return to play from looking at this. But I'm very interested in the outcome of this study. I think it's going to turn into 20 more studies after it, because we know very little about the mental health or mental readiness. And I do believe it's something that's going to play a critical role, not only in coming back, but succeeding after you come back.
You know, one of the things I looked at when I was getting my master's degree was applying this Kubler-Ross five stages of death, but obviously to injury.
Right.
And what we found was, you know, anger, denial, depression, bargaining, acceptance, and, you know, that third stage of depression that's the one that we had to watch out for, because, right, you know, obviously they're going to be angry and they're going to deny that it happened. But once they got it in, how fast can we get on board a sports psychologist, right, if we need, you know, to prescribe some anti-anxiety medicines, some depression medicines to get them, right, over? And then finally get them to bargaining and then acceptance. And they go through all these different phases when the injury happens and then when they're in rehab and then when it's returned to play. So yeah. I think your study is going to be huge. I think it's going to blow the lid off a few things.
Yeah, totally into that and agree with all that. And it's going to make us all better at doing this, you know. So
before we let you go, because we know your time is very, very, that's valuable, right, tell us just a little bit. You know, I was as skeptical as you were about dry needling. Mm-hmm. And one of my good friends, his name is Seth Kaplan, president and CEO over at Baton Rouge Physical Therapy at the lake in Baton, mm-hmm, Rouge, Louisiana. And I had him come and do some continuing education units a year and a half, 2 years ago about dry needling. And I was as skeptical as you were, and I was a patient just like you were. And I said, you know what? I don't believe this works. Show me. And you know what? Boom, it worked. So tell us a little bit about your experience and where you think this is going in the sports medicine world.
Well, so here's my testimony, you know, for that. So I run, I lift, I work out pretty hard, lost 50 pounds in the last year and a half, and have really tried to get my act back together. And part of the issues with that for me has been a left hamstring, mm-hmm, that just tight, and I could jog at 5.5-6 miles an hour. But if I wanted to open up and run some intervals or do that kind of stuff, boom, there goes my hamstring, my glutes shut down. I can't, you know, and then I'm crippled for 3 weeks and I get off my deal, and I just fought it for literally a year. Mm-hmm. And so Jeff Kaplan, our head trainer and physical therapist at the Texas, goes, just let me dry needle you. And I'm going, that doesn't work. You know, he goes, just give me one shot at it. Right. So I said, you know, I got to do something. Let's do this. And so literally 6 needles in my hamstring, 3 of which got major twitches, never felt them go in. But boy, mm-hmm, when they get in that trigger point, you know where they are. And I go, so what's this doing? He goes, it just resets the neural firing pattern. Your hamstring will let go. I promise you it'll, mm-hmm, do that. And so I literally got up off of the dang table and was well, and sprinting the next day, no issue, that kind of stuff. So I went, okay, there's something to this, because right, I was a huge skeptic and didn't, right, think it was going to work. So that transcended for me to watch it a lot more closely, what we do. And, you know, there are a lot of muscle related things, and the same thing for the release therapists and other things approaching it in different ways that keep guys off fields.
Right.
And little adductor issues, little hamstring issues. They're not all pulls, they're not all injuries, you know, and those things respond very quickly. You know, your cuff responds very quickly to it. You know, there's just so many things that just resetting the little trigger points makes a big difference. So it's not the end-all, be-all, cure-all, but as a adjunct to keep function at a higher level and to be able to play when you might not be able to from these issues, it's the biggest change for that I've seen while I've been doing this as a team physician, I think.
Right. It's one of those tools in the toolbox. And before that, right, or really only access to trigger point treatment was this combo unit of E-stim and ultrasound, right, and you try to nail the trigger point and,
right,
hopefully it releases. And, right, you know, if it doesn't, you went to active release or Graston,
right,
or,
right,
something along those lines. Right. Yeah, great.
And I think, like you said, it's part of the toolbox, and when it fits, you use it, you know, and it works great.
Well, Dr. Lowe, I want to thank you very much for your time. You know, we really appreciate what you're doing here for the sports medicine community. We know that what you're doing is making a huge difference in what we all do. So we really appreciate it. For more about Dr. Lowe, you can go visit him at, again, our website at www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT. Look under our link under partnerships. And again, we've been fortunate enough to affiliate with Dr. Lowe and his group. And again, he gave you his email if you have any questions. And again, can you give that to us?
It's walter.r.lowe, L-O-W-E, at uth.tmc.edu.
Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks, Josh.
All right, so I want to thank you for joining us on the Sports Medicine Broadcast. Again, you can find that at sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. I want to thank Dr. Josh Allen and Dr. Mark Knobloch for all their help with the interviews throughout the course of our live session of the 13th Annual Sports Medicine Update provided by Memorial Hermann. So again, Memorial Hermann's 13th Annual Sports Medicine Update has given us a great opportunity to interview all these guests in the course of 2 days. So I want to thank Dr. Josh Yellen, Dr. Mark Knobloch for all their help, my coworker Bill Hale, and my students Jasmine Dozal and Sarah Avina for all their help doing recording, and also athletic trainer at South Houston High School, Michelle Nettles, for stepping in when I needed her to there. So again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. Find it on iTunes or your favorite source. Make sure you leave us some comments. Tell us what you want to hear. So I guess that's a wrap.